From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Donald Trump and the President of France, Emmanuel Macron, put a famously white-knuckled handshake behind them as Macron warmly welcomed Trump in Paris today for a visit to mark Bastille Day and the 100th anniversary of the United States' entry into World War I. The two leaders held a news conference, and they took two questions from the French media and two questions from the American media each. Macron spoke of shared convictions and shared history, seeing eye to eye on fighting terrorism, but he also spoke of not agreeing on one issue in particular.
Climate. Well, here we know what our disagreements are. We have expressed them on a number of occasions, but I think it is important that we can continue to talk about it. I very much respect the decision taken by President Trump.
That's President Emmanuel Macron speaking through a translator, of course. President Donald Trump did pull the United States out of the multinational Paris Climate Change Accord. Domenico Montanaro is NPR's lead politics editor. Hi there, Domenico.
Hey there.
Okay, so climate change talk, but also there's a lot of focus on Russia and Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting on Russia.
There was.
Did the president take any questions about that, and what did he say?
He did, and one of the American reporters asked about Donald Trump Jr., and President Trump gave kind of a rambling answer, kind of wide-ranging here. He continued to say some of what we saw him say in a transcript last night from a print interview with Reuters that he's now said on camera, essentially, that most people would have taken this meeting, that his son is a wonderful young man, it was a Russian lawyer, not a government lawyer, not someone representing Russia, and he tried to say that this is standard politics. He even referenced former Attorney General Loretta Lynch and the fact that she had approved or her Justice Department had approved the Russian lawyer's visa. Now, a couple things here that we really need to annotate when it comes to what Trump is saying. This is not standard politics. Mm-hmm. You know, getting an email that explicitly says whether or not this woman turns out to be somebody who is a Russian government lawyer. The email said from the associate, Rob Goldstone, to Donald Trump Jr., this is part of a Russian government effort to help your father win. And Donald Trump Jr.'s response was, I love it, and I hope it's what you say it is, and especially later in the summer when then it could be used in a campaign. So this can't be dismissed as something that is normal politics, the way the game is played, it's dirty. This is different. This is not what normally happens in campaigns, and this looks like an attempt to get information by any way or means possible, ethical or not.
It's interesting because I note that the president said in that long answer that, you talked about that he himself had only been in politics for 2 years and that the question that the reporter had asked him was the context was about the President Trump's nominee to be FBI director, Christopher Wray, said yesterday during his confirmation hearing that Wray himself said that if you get an email like this, you should report it to the FBI.
And we're starting to see more Republicans on Capitol Hill who are among the professional class, people who know how these things operate, who have started to say that this is not the way things go. You've seen a lot of Republican operatives come forward and say they've been involved in many campaigns and they've never met with someone under the aegis that they were representing a foreign government. And ignorance is not an excuse. If you have any kind of ethical compass, you sit there and you take it in. And if you don't know, you forward it to an attorney. Have a question that you ask about whether or not this is appropriate or not. And that didn't seem to be the case for Donald Trump Jr.
Well, how much is the Russia investigation hanging over the president's visit to France? Because the French president, Emmanuel Macron, has been rather vocal in his criticism, accusing Russia of working against his own campaign in the French election.
Yeah, I'll have to go back and check and see if Macron said any more when it came to Russia. He did say that he wanted to stay out of Americans' domestic politics. But Macron himself, this is a kind of an interesting situation because Macron himself had been the victim of hacking that was reportedly at the behest of the Russian government as well. So he has a very different take on how this should go. At the same time, you know, geopolitics is complicated. It's not binary. It is. Is the fact that the United States and France are two strong, longtime allies and need each other on various pieces. We saw the two of them talk about the fact that they have differences of opinion, especially, as you noted, when it comes to climate, when it comes to, you know, NATO defense spending, what have you. But they do need each other when it comes to, you know, common defense. But, you know, Macron is going to have a different philosophy and view on how to deal with Putin and Russia.
Well, let's just stick with the big Russia here story for just a second. We got about 30 seconds, Domenico, because I understand there are developments in Washington today that the Senate Judiciary Committee is asking Donald Trump Jr. to testify. What's the latest?
Yeah, Chuck Grassley, who is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, has sent a letter confirmed by our NPR's Jeff Bennett to have Donald Trump Jr. testify open under oath before the Senate Judiciary Committee as early as next week.
Domenico Montanaro, he's NPR's lead politics editor. Thank you as always, Domenico.
You're quite welcome.
And we want to learn more now about the newest version of the Senate Republican health care bill, which was unveiled today. Sarah Cliff covers health policy for Vox.com. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
And we understand the new bill is a lot like the old bill, the one that was so unpopular that Republicans decided not to hold a vote on it before the 4th of July recess. The new one today, though, has some enticements, we understand, thrown in by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to try to lure the GOP holdout. So what's different?
It does. And I'd say the biggest enticements are ones meant to lure conservatives. One of the big changes that's actually more significant than I expected is they are going to allow plans in the individual market that once again can deny coverage for pre-existing conditions, charge sick people more, really return to the market that we had before the Affordable Care Act. You would still have those comprehensive plans, the ones that have to take everybody. But the expectation is those would get quite expensive as the healthy people kind of flock to the plans that are only allowed for them.
These are the people with pre-existing conditions and people who are sick under Obamacare. You were not allowed to charge more for them.
Exactly. This was one of the really key reforms in the Affordable Care Act, saying that insurance companies in the individual market have to accept everybody and can't ask questions about your health. And the Senate bill, the revised version we received today, says that insurance companies can offer two options, one that covers everybody and covers a robust set of benefits, and one that only covers the people it wants to cover and covers fewer benefits.
Is this the amendment that was written by Ted Cruz?
It is. It is the one that Senator Ted Cruz has been offering, and it seems like it'll be enough to get him on board. But the question is, what does it do to people who are worried about coverage gains? Moderate senators like Susan Collins, who did get some things in this new version, but not nearly as much as the conservatives are getting.
I want to hear what the moderates got, but isn't the concern about this idea that you could have a bare bones policy as long as you had another, full coverage policy? That the concern is that means that all the healthy people will flock to the bare bones and you still aren't funding the way insurance should the people who are sick and need the other policies.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You'd essentially see the comprehensive plan become something like a high risk pool where the people who couldn't get those other policies or who, use a lot of healthcare and want comprehensive benefits, they would end up together in this more expensive plan. So the insurance industry opposes this change. They worry that it will destabilize the market, and there is a lot of merit to that worry.
Now, two of the Republican senators who were holding out, Rob Portman of Ohio and Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, were really upset about the funding for opioid addiction care that had been cut. Has something been added there?
Yeah, so there is an additional $45 billion in this bill for opioid funding. There's also an additional $70 generally for high-cost patients. That's not opioid-specific, but could end up covering some of those people with significant healthcare costs. So that's essentially the carrot being given to moderates, but it's still a relatively small one. We've talked to a lot of experts here at Vox who question whether $45 billion over 10 years is enough to really do something significant to fight a very widespread opioid epidemic.
Well, I'm wondering, too, did you say $70 to cover the...
$70 billion.
Oh, well,
sorry,
that's
about
okay.
That.
That's a little more. I was going to say 70. That is not going far at all. Look, what about Susan Collins and the moderates who were overall concerned that too many people were going to lose insurance with the Republican plan?
Yeah, so we are just seeing some early interviews with Senator Collins from reporters on the Hill who are saying she is a no on the current version, that this was not enough to win her over. And there is, only two senators that Mitch McConnell can lose. So if you see two more people come out, if you get to three, that is enough to sink this effort. So it really feels very much teetering on the edge at this point.
Well, hasn't Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who feels that none of these plans from the Republicans have gone far enough, he wants to see Obamacare completely repealed. Hasn't he already said he's going to vote against beginning debate next week, which is the next big step?
He has. I didn't count him because we haven't heard from him since this latest version came out. But I think you're exactly right that if we have Collins saying no, Rand already saying no, you just need one more defector to, you know, make to stop this from going forward.
And aren't we having a new accounting from the government on how many people will lose health care and how much this will cost?
Yes. Yeah, so we're expecting the Congressional Budget Office to release on Monday a new estimate. Experts who have looked at the bill so far don't think it'll be very different. The last estimate on the Senate bill estimated that 22 million people would lose coverage. And early estimates, you know, just eyeballing this, think it'll be about the same number.
Look, President Trump, we've said this elsewhere in the program. He said last night he'd be very angry if this doesn't happen. But if this doesn't happen, is that it? Does that mean that Obamacare stays?
It stays, but it also needs some work. There are some challenges in the marketplace that Republicans will have to deal with. You can't really leave it on autopilot.
Yeah, it needs fixes as well, which Democrats and Republicans have said. Sarah Cliff, who covers health policy for Vox, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Remember back on January 27th, 16 state attorneys general, all of them Democrats, filed a brief in federal court to stop the new President Trump's executive order that aimed to temporarily ban many refugees and immigrants from entering the country, the travel ban. Well, since then, at least 19 AGs have launched more than a dozen lawsuits, about one every 2 weeks, to challenge President Trump's efforts on environmental rules, student loan regulations, funding the Affordable Care Act. The state attorney general's job has always been defined as protecting state interests. Is that role changing? Is that a good thing? Well, according to conservative commentator Charles Krauthammer, it is. He's written, in effect, somebody's got to step in when Congress won't. Paul Nolet is a professor of political science from Marquette University and author of Federalism on Trial, State Attorneys General, and National Policymaking in Contemporary America. Let's see what he thinks. Professor, welcome.
Great to talk with you.
And give us a little backstory here. This did not start with these current Democratic attorneys general. The day that Obamacare, as it's now been embraced by the Obama administration, was signed into law, 13 Republican AGs filed suit. They were joined by another dozen. So this is not new.
That's right. And like you said, with the Affordable Care Act, probably the biggest single piece of legislation through the Obama administration, 5 minutes after it was signed into law, Republicans had a lawsuit ready to go. After that, in the years of the Obama administration, right to the end, there were dozens of suits coming from Texas and Oklahoma and West Virginia and many other states as well, led by Republican AGs pushing back against the Obama administration in a number of ways. So what we're seeing with the Democratic AGs is not entirely new. We saw this in the last administration as well.
Well, and in the last administration, they were successful, the Republican AGs. They didn't overturn Obamacare, but they were able to get the Medicaid expansion, something that states would decide on.
Absolutely. And that ended up being one of the big, and still is one of the big, focal points of the battle over health care nowadays. And so the AG's lawsuit, which originally was seen as kind of totally out of left field, like there's no way that that's going to succeed, they ended up having that surprising victory and really changing health care policy and politics pretty dramatically.
So now you come to what we're seeing now. What are some of the issues that attorneys general have agreed on across the country now?
AGs, and particularly Democratic AGs, have collaborated on a number of issues already just in the first few months of the Trump administration. One of the most prominent ones right from the beginning was the lawsuit targeting the so-called travel ban, which is going to be reviewed by the Supreme Court in the coming months. But in addition to that, there's been a number of other issues as well. A number of AGs have gotten involved in the fight over so-called sanctuary cities. So cities that are under threat from the Trump administration of losing money if they don't aggressively enforce immigration law, a number of AGs have come to those cities' defense. In a number of other issues, particularly environmental issues, we've seen a lot of activity already dealing with methane rules and pesticide labeling and greenhouse gases. In addition to all of that, too, there was that interesting lawsuit about a month ago filed by two Democratic AGs in Maryland and in the District of Columbia that sued Trump directly, saying that he's violating the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, the clause of the Constitution that doesn't come up very often, even in constitutional law classes.
They were claiming that he's benefiting financially from his office.
Right, and that his benefiting from his office is actually harming the state's interests. One advantage that AGs have when they bring these lawsuits, and it's an advantage that, say, private interest groups don't have, is that they have a lot more claim to what's called standing, which is saying, hey, we actually have a lawsuit, we've suffered a harm, and we should be able to enter court and bring this lawsuit.
Well, now, when you talk about Maryland's Attorney General Brian Frosch, who's launched a lot of lawsuits involving the president, he joined, as you said, D.C.'s Attorney General Kara Sine. This was the suit alleging that President Trump was benefiting from foreign governments because of his hotel and golf businesses that they might then stay at, members of foreign governments. Well, in the case of the Maryland AG, his legislature passed a budget line giving him $1 million a year to hire lawyers for the lawsuits he's involved in. Is that usual?
This is something that's occurred more and more often and kind of going in both directions. So in the Maryland example you just mentioned, you had a pretty friendly legislature encouraging the AG through additional budgeting and so forth to bring these lawsuits. In some other states where the legislature is controlled by the opposite party of the AG, there's been a lot of conflict over lawsuits that the AG is getting involved in. Hmm. Or even ones that they're not getting involved in, saying that they should be suing the administration. And this was common during the Obama administration. So this is something that, especially in the last few years, like that second half of the Obama administration, it's really opened up this big polarized partisan back and forth between state legislatures, governors, and the attorneys general.
Well, you say the states have standing. One would say, well, how could the states have standing in something like President Trump violating the Emoluments Clause? And I'm noticing that it's Maryland and D.C. So are they saying that their standing is that their businesses would suffer because President Trump's hotel might draw the foreign dignitaries and it would disadvantage the local businesses? Is that what's their standing?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically getting at it. The idea is that by having essentially guests staying in the Trump branded hotels, it is taking away business that would go to state or city controlled entities or hotels. So convention centers, for instance, owned by the city, the District of Columbia, or owned by Maryland. And what's interesting here is that the lawsuit tracked almost exactly a former lawsuit that was filed a few months before this by an advocacy group called CRU, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. But one of the big flaws of that lawsuit that a number of people had pointed out as soon as it was filed is, hey, what's your standing? How can you say that CRU has been harmed in any way by Trump's alleged Emoluments Clause violation? And so Maryland and D.C. stepped in here to try to bolster that part of the lawsuit.
Hmm. Well, Maryland's Frosch and then New York's Eric Schneiderman and Massachusetts' Maura Healey, all these AGs, have been some of the most outspoken and are involved with some of the most lawsuits. But there are critics who say this is political, that they're using it for gain and for their own political aspirations. As you look at the suits and you look at what states are doing, what do you think?
Well, it's hard to deny that it's political in some sense. If you look at the lineup in these lawsuits, it's pretty much all Democratic AGs that are bringing these lawsuits against Trump. And during the Obama years, it was pretty much all Republican AGs that were bringing these lawsuits. So you see a lot of this big partisan split, I think. I do think that it's not just about cutting out a public profile and getting public attention for run for higher office. I mean, that certainly plays into some of the calculation here, I think. But I think it's because AGs really have embraced their new national role in a way that these actors realize they can really make a difference and pursue what they see as good policy.
Well, and some of these AGs, and we've, heard from them, it's not just that they feel that, they want to score points. They genuinely feel that things like climate change, for instance, are imperative to their state's survival. And so they're going to go their own way or sue the president if he doesn't.
Absolutely.
So then you have Charles Krauthammer, one of the most conservative commentators writing in the National Review, his piece is entitled The Revolt of the Attorneys General, that this is a good thing, that it's a good thing that, you know, Republican AGs blocked President Obama's executive order that would have essentially legalized 4 million illegal immigrants. These were the parents of the Dreamers. And that it's also a good thing that Democrats are now doing it, because it is, he writes, a reassuring sign of the creativity and suppleness to the American Constitution, of its amphibian capacity to grow a new limb when an old one atrophies. And the old one, he says, is Congress that just isn't doing its job.
Yeah, and I think that there's something to that. I mean, one of the geniuses of federalism, even going back to the time of the framing of the Constitution, one of the big arguments that James Madison made was that, hey, federalism and separation of powers provides something of a double security to the liberties of the people. And I think this is a modern example of that. I do think one concern with all of this activity, though, mm-hmm. is that a lot of times you expect politics to be kind of, you know, at least somewhat transparent and being so the public can follow along and know who's doing what. But when a lot of the activity over environmental law and immigration and healthcare, when it starts moving to the courts, things start getting very complicated and very difficult to follow, even though the litigation has a huge impact on American politics. And so one concern that I do have, again, is that as activity moves out of Congress, let's say Congress is stalemated and they can't do anything, then there's a concern that moving it to the courts is not really ultimately great for democracy and or great for transparency either.
Yeah. Paul Nolet, a professor of political science at Marquette, also author of Federalism on Trial, State Attorneys General, and National Policymaking in Contemporary America. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This week, two former employees of the pharmaceutical company Insys Therapeutics pleaded guilty to violating anti-kickback laws. Now, this is a particularly important case because the company makes the drug Subsys, which contains the powerful and addictive opioid fentanyl. And that's a major part of the growing opioid epidemic ravaging parts of the country. For more on this story, Lynette Lopez joins us. She's senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. She's with us from New York. Hi there, Lynette.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. So first of all, tell us more about these employees and exactly what they did at Insys to break the law.
Okay. Well, these two employees specifically were they were managing a program for Insys. It was a speakers program for doctors, training them how to use Subsys. That was the intent, or at least that's the intent on paper. The reality was, and these again, they pleaded guilty. So the reality was that they were basically bribing doctors to prescribe Subsys. And one of the allegations that is still being looked into is whether or not they were encouraging the doctors to prescribe Subsys for off-label indications, which is to say for pain that would not necessarily be treated with Subsys. Remember that Subsys is four times more – or fentanyl is four times more powerful than morphine. So it's a very, very, very powerful pain medication. The sting on Insys kind of started back in December when officials in Boston – filed charges against several executives of the company, including the former CEO. So this is all starting to play out now and has been throughout the year with several medical practitioners who also had prescribed Subsys and been a part of this speakers program, pleading guilty to including a nurse and several other practitioners in Boston and mm-hmm. Florida and Alabama, pleading guilty just over-prescribing medication.
Right. So there's that. And then in part of this this recent case that we're talking about, I mean, they were also found to have basically forged documents to make it appear that that these programs that they were sponsoring were legit. I mean, this is really interesting, Lynette, because there has been some focus for some time now on the role of doctors and prescribers in terms of the opioid addiction crisis in the United States. Perhaps not as much as people would like on the pharmaceutical companies themselves who make some of these drugs. I mean, is that what we're seeing
sure.
now?
Yeah, of course. Senator Claire McCaskill basically called out Insys and a bunch of other companies, including Mylan and a private company called Purdue, that asking for marketing materials for these companies. What are your speakers programs? What are you telling doctors to do? How are you telling them to prescribe them? And then the other part of this that has gotten a little bit more attention is that some of these doctors then go and commit insurance fraud to be able to overcharge insurance companies, Medicare and Medicaid for payment here. And in fact, Attorney General Jeff Sessions engaged in a sting today. 412 medical practitioners were charged with Medicare, Medicaid and insurance fraud related to the opioid crisis.
Lynette Lopez is senior finance correspondent for Business Insider, walking us through the very interesting development regarding Insys Therapeutics, maker of a powerful drug that includes fentanyl in it. Thank you so much, Lynette.
Have a good one.
This week, we launched our summer series on lakes. Now, we asked you for your favorites, and boy, did you deliver. So many waded in. We'll hear from many of you over the course of the summer. But let's start today with Lisa Burke from Medina, Ohio. She had many memories, including one of a lake that her friend's family took her to.
The first is the most beautiful, deep blue, crystal clear lake in Michigan called Torch Lake. My friend's dad took us water skiing first thing in the morning when the water was like glass, and we could look through our skis and see the stones on the bottom of the lake. One thing about Torch is the temperature. Located in northern Michigan, it's frigid cold.
Hi, my name is Josie Barr from Wichita, Kansas, and Jenny Lake in Grand Teton National Park is the most beautiful place on earth.
Lewis Horn III from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Lake Superior is an amazing lake with a beautiful shoreline, but the water itself is a bit frigid for summer swimming. For swimming, I'd visit the west coast of Michigan's Lower Peninsula.
This is Kristen Shields in Bend, Oregon. Squam Lake in New Hampshire has a very special place in my heart. We had friends who had a cabin on the lake, and for 20 years we were able to visit them nearly every year. It was so sad when they had to sell the cabin.
Hi, this is Tana Byers from York County, PA. Our local state parks have really awesome lakes for kayaking, fishing, hiking, camping. So carry on, have fun at your local lakes, and wear your life jacket.
Good advice. And let's get some more from another listener, Steve Lunt. He wrote us that July has been Lake Appreciation Month for almost 20 years in the U.S. We knew that. No, we didn't. We had no idea. So we called up Steve to ask him about it. He's a lake quality scientist with the Metro Wastewater Reclamation District in Denver, Colorado. He's also a certified lake manager with the North American Lake Management Society, or NAMS, which sponsors Lake Appreciation Month. Steve, what exactly is NAMS?
It's been around for 37 years. It's just a group of scientists, citizens that live on lakes, people that manage lakes. And for, like I said, 20 years, there's been a Lake Appreciation Month for July. And so it's been kind of fun.
Well, we all have our party hats on now that we know. But, you know, you have on your website different things that people can do. For instance, you say people can arrange a lake or watershed cleanup, start a watershed storm drain stenciling program.
Yeah, so I'm actually doing one here in Denver where you just get school groups, camp groups, kids to team up, and we go out and we actually go and find storm drains. And we mark them with a plaque that says this leads to a stream or to a lake.
Yeah, so don't dump things in it.
Exactly. And so it's just a good way to educate kids, educate the citizens, and then they can do their part and make lakes as clean as we can get them.
You say ask your local lake agency about shadowing a lake manager for a day. What would they see them do?
Well, so a lot of times a lake manager goes out onto a lake, they take samples, they take measurements, they're kind of like a lake doctor, and they go out there and see how the lake is doing, especially during the warmer season when algae is growing. And so a lot of people call me up and say, you know, I'd like to go out to Bar Lake. That's the lake I work on downstream of Denver. And I take people out and just kind of talk about what the watershed is like. And it's just a great way to see a lake from a different perspective.
You mentioned the watershed. These are the streams or rainfall catchalls that feed a lake. One of the biggest concerns about lakes, we know about the invasive Asian carp. What are some of the concerns across the country?
You know, invasive species is definitely a big one. We have the zebra mussel, the quagga mussel. And so many of those invasive species can easily be transported by boat from lake to lake. And in fact, I had a hard time getting on a lake yesterday to monitor it just because they do boat inspections here and they're very thorough with that. So
wait a minute. Are you saying like on the bottom of your boat, some invasive fish might be clinging there?
Yeah, well, not a fish per se, but, you know, like a plant fragment or these quagga mussels. So these are freshwater mussels that can attach to a boat and get transported from one lake to another. So that's definitely a big concern when going from one lake to the other. And in Colorado, we have a great monitoring program for invasive species. So we have a good program where we do boat inspections and decontamination. And people that go out to the lakes now are just kind of expect this little extra process. You just can't launch your boat and go out into the water. And even people like lake managers have to do it too.
My dear friend, the late, great Marty Sender, used to get in his kayak. He was determined to clear out the Charles River, not a lake, but the Charles River, of this invasive sort of viney thing that had just... And he, you know, slowly but surely, he started a movement. I mean, he would just pull them out all day, every day. So these plants can be strangling.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, there's definitely plants that are not native and don't belong here, and there's no natural predators or a way to keep them in check and balance, and they can definitely take over a lake. And it's shocking for, you know, a person that goes out to a lake one year and the next year they come back and it looks completely different.
Yeah, you remind me to check in Ithaca, New York, one of my favorite lakes, Cayuga. Acres have been taken over by this invasive Asian weed hydrilla. The Army Corps of Engineers is now going to go in to try to start cleaning out this. It's like a stringy weed. You can't swim or boat through it. It's choking off wildlife. You know, it's almost like out of a little shop of horrors
right.
that took it over. Let's look at some other things you say people can do. Arrange a cleanup event.
Yeah, that's a great event for families, even for businesses that look for doing events where a lake can organize a weekend where you come out and walk the shoreline and you pick up the trash. I mean, that's kind of an easy thing to do, and definitely a lot of trash ends up in lakes. And one of the big complaints when people go to a lake is, you know, they want to see a beautiful lake and not a cluttered or a messy shoreline. So an easy thing to do, even just on your own, is in the month of July, is to go pick up some trash and do a shoreline cleanup.
You also talk about, I mean, you obviously as a scientist and other people who manage lakes, they are testing the water. But you say host an activity and bring enough sampling gear, ID keys and other materials for everyone to join in the fun. Are you talking about people themselves going out and sampling? Like, what would they do with it?
Part of Lake Appreciation Month, there's this other event that goes on in July is the Great Secchi Dip-In. And so there's a way for people to use this instrument. It's a Secchi disc, pretty easy to make one. And people take a measurement of water clarity. You don't have to have all the fancy equipment and all that stuff, but there are some things that people can do to kind of just learn a little bit about the science behind what goes on in a lake. So we have the Great American Secchi Dip-In that occurs every July, and that's been going on for 24 years, too, that people, I don't think, know about, and we like to get that message out.
Did we miss it? Or
no, you can still do it. So NALMS as well organizes this. It started off with Kent State University with Bob Carlson way back in 94, and it's called the Great American Secchi Dip-In, where it's a snapshot in time of water clarity across North America. And so anybody that has a Secchi disc can find one, can make one. It's just a black and white disc. You lower it into the water, measure its clarity, and you send in that information. And then over time, you can track how clear your lake is. And you know, that's a big thing when people go to a lake. They want to make sure it's nice and clear, and they can see their toes when they walk in.
I am going to get myself a Secchi disc.
You do that.
Steve Lund, who knew? I mean, this has just been so great to, you know, really find out how deep the passion for lakes in this country goes. You mentioned one lake, Bar Lake. What are some other lakes that are just your favorites?
Well, I'm from the Pacific Northwest, so growing up, I water skied on Silver Lake near Castle Rock, Washington, by Mount St. Helens. It's a beautiful little lake that you can water skiing on that just is, you know, is in the woods and nobody really knows as much about it, but it was a great place to learn to water ski and to play during the summers. Professionally, I've worked on many lakes. I sampled probably over 90 lakes in Indiana doing water quality monitoring. And so there's definitely, professionally, there's a lot of lakes I've enjoyed over the years.
Very few people can put together that sentence. I've sampled 90 lakes in Indiana. But we're glad you did. Steve Lund, he's a water quality scientist, and he wrote in to tell us about, woohoo, it's Lake Appreciation Month. Steve, thank you for adding to the festivities here.
Well, thank you. Thank you for talking about lakes.
So next week, we're going to hear about having a lake house in the family for generations. We're going to hear about the literature inspired by lakes. And we still want to hear about your favorite lakes. Ali Nolert from Norman, Oklahoma, described a hike he went on to Treasure Lake in the Wichita Mountains on the 4th of July.
You're walking through the rocks and the desert and the cactus, and you come across this fabulous lake with steep red rock walls and deep blue And on the way back, we're just walking down the stream bed and have to make a bit of a detour because there's a very large bison standing just munching some grass just about 10 yards off the trail.
Okay, then, top that. Your lake story is welcome at hereandnow.org.
Let's take a few minutes for an ancient history lesson. We have this warning, though. If you're eating right now, this conversation is about human waste and the way we dispose of it. But we do encourage you to stick with us because, as it turns out, you can learn a lot about a civilization by looking at its waste. We found that out when we talked to Brandeis professor Anne Olga Koloski-Ostro. Last summer, I spoke to her. She studies toilets and sewage systems in the Roman Empire from the 1st century BCE to the beginning of the 1st century in the current era. And she stopped by our studios for a fascinating discussion on Roman toilets.
We used to think there were no toilets in people's private homes, that if they used facilities in the high empire, they used public facilities that were associated with bath buildings or near the amphitheater.
I mean, the Romans are famous for their baths, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But now we understand that everybody did have a private house toilet. Only those were cesspit toilets.
But of course, we are talking about BCE and just the first century AD, if I can still call it that.
But Romans knew how to make flush toilets.
Well, they knew how to make aqueducts, right? So moving water around wasn't necessarily, they were masters at it.
Yeah. They could have had house flush toilets, but they chose not to, except for public ones, multi-seater toilets where up to 60 to 100 people sat around a room on open holes. Those were flush toilets.
So from, you know, your expertise here as a scholar of classical studies, why is it surprising to you that, first of all, there was a toilet in virtually every Roman household?
It isn't surprising to me. I thought that might have been the case, and I think 100 years of excavators just overlook them. But what is interesting is that Romans didn't have sewer traps, and they didn't have the systems that we have connecting our modern toilets to sewers, and they were really afraid to put their house toilets connected to the sewer system. So instead, they once a year roughly maybe excavated their own house toilets into the garden and raised their vegetables on the human excrement from the house, or they sold the contents of their house toilets. It was a commodity that you could sell to a guy going by with a wagon calling out, looking for your excrement, who would then collect from your cesspit the excrement to bring it to more commercial agriculture.
This does not sound sanitary at all.
Well, of course, the Romans didn't understand germs. They are also a people of extreme superstitions, and fear of sitting on a toilet with a sewer connection was something very real to them.
But why?
Because they believed in demons that lived in dark, dirty places, and because occasionally, as you were sitting on those public toilets over a real sewer, buildup of mephitic gases would cause a fire to burst through the seats of the toilet.
Right. So you're saying that methane gas from the waste would actually
cause fires
in some of these toilets? Okay.
Absolutely. Or rats would crawl out of them and bite you. There's one ancient story from a writer called Aelian who tells us about an octopus that climbed out of the sea into a house toilet, which did have a sewer connection, and ate all the pickled fish in a pantry of this guy's house.
What you just said made me wonder, where were these toilets located in a typical Roman household?
Usually, they're in the kitchen, and that's where anybody who uses the toilet doesn't have proper washing facilities to clean their hands. And then they step over to the counter.
So this is every public health official's worst nightmare by far. And yet it was a daily reality.
It was.
In ancient Rome. Now, the Romans were many things. One of those things is they were meticulous record keepers, right? And they were also meticulous historians of their own history.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if, granted, we're still more than a millennia away from the germ theory of disease.
Yeah.
But does any of your research sort of overlap with Roman historians' accounting of their, you know, own plagues or diseases that we might trace back to these toilet habits?
Well, I don't know if we could trace them directly back to them, but we can say now that from studying the actual compacted excrement in toilets, scientists have found evidence of ringworm and whipworm and things that would have caused severe dysentery and severe intestinal cramping and severe pains for a large part of the population.
Is enough of the human waste that was put into these cesspit toilets well enough preserved these many, many, many centuries later that you can actually analyze them?
Amazingly, yes. Not everywhere and not every place, but I can tell you, for example, of research done in the north of England in Roman soldiers' camps. And we can see from the excavation of the excrement that the officers ate a much better diet and had flour free of boll weevils and bugs compared to the lowly foot soldiers' toilets. So it can tell us about diet and the quality of the food, even, in the place where the people are using those toilets.
Well, Anne Olga Kolosky-Ostrow is a professor and chair of the Classical Studies Department at Brandeis University. She's also author of the book, The Archaeology of Sanitation in Roman Italy. It's been a true pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna, for me too.
And our interview first aired last July. Truly something for everyone on this program. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.